All right, Daniel chapter 6. If you want to look with me at the last two verses of chapter 5. You guys remember the scene from all of chapter 5. Belshazzar was the king at the time. He was ruling. From what it looks like, Mama told him about Daniel, as he needed one with wisdom. And Daniel comes and tells him with the handwriting. Remember that the handwriting on the wall, this hand mysteriously appears right in the middle of their party. They were partying and celebrating all the gods of all the things of the earth, the gold, the bronze, the iron, the wood, and all of that. And then he sent out to actually get the sanctified vessels that were taken from the temple and brought them back, and they were drinking out of that. And then this hand suddenly appears and wrote on the wall, Mene, Mene, Tekel, Upsharsin, which basically means you have been weighed and found wanting. You're a lightweight, is what he says basically to the king. And then the message is interpreted, and in verse 28 it says, your kingdom has been divided and given to the Medes and Persians. Verse 29, Belshazzar gives the command, gives Daniel what he promised him, a purple robe and a gold chain for around his neck. And verse 30 says, that very night Belshazzar, king of the Chaldeans, was slain, and Darius the Mede received the kingdom, being about 62 years old. So that's kind of the running start into Daniel chapter 6. If I was thinking, I would have had Jim sing, he's got the whole world in his hands. Remember that song? Seems like, I remember that song as a kid. It should be like a Sunday morning worship song, I think. Anybody remember the lyrics? I just said them, right? He's got the whole world in his hands. But anybody remember the second line of that? He's got the itty-bitty babies, is that it, in his hands? Which is actually kind of cool, because when you look at Daniel chapter 6, actually Daniel's chapters 1 through 6 is all kind of the history point of this book. And then when we get into chapter 7, we tap into the prophetic side of the book. But one of the things I hope that we see tonight, and I say hopefully because my notes are in space somewhere, but is that God is sovereign. God is sovereign. God is in control. God is in control over the big picture and in the people that control the big things. But then, like that theologically sound itty-bitty babies, he's got them in his hands. It's God's got control of the big picture, and then he's got control of the little things. He's aware of what's going on with you and me personally. And I don't know where each of you individually are tonight, but one of those things may minister to you. I know at different times, just looking at our world and thinking, things are out of control, and then I remember, oh wait, no, you've got the whole world in your hands. And then there's things in my life that'll happen, not small things like vehicle repairs today on two different vehicles, or that's kind of normal stuff, but a diagnosis or one of your kids is in a car accident, and big picture, I don't care at all about. Right then I want to know that he's got my babies in his hands, or he's got me in his hands. So that's a lot of what I see in Daniel chapter 6 is the sovereignty of God. No matter what the circumstances look like, God is and remains in control. So, Matt, if you want to skip ahead to chapter 6, verse 1. It says, it pleased Darius to set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be over the whole kingdom, and over these three governors, of whom Daniel was one, that the satraps might give account to them so that the king would suffer no loss. So the governors and the satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful, nor was there any error or fault in him. Now, I promise we're going to get to Daniel and the lion's den tonight. I'm going to try, okay? But even that, I don't know what your impressions are of that. I say that just because I'm going to bog down for a little while. And if you're waiting for that, it is coming. But our impressions or our thoughts of Daniel and the lion's den are, is maybe some of you decorated your baby's rooms with that theme, or, you know, we think of that, or you've seen cartoons, and I don't know where you picture Daniel kind of on the age chart, but when we line things up historically, he was about 80 years old, 80, 85, maybe a little bit more at this point in time. So not the picture of vibrant youth, probably weary, certainly dependent on the Lord. I know the older I get, the more I realize how dependent on the Lord I am. And he's in a position here where he's being considered, when we just look at how this is broke down, Darius set over the kingdom 120 satraps to be over the whole kingdom. So think of these leaders. Darius is the king, or the one over all. And remember, we're into the kingdom of the Medes and the Persians here, so he doesn't have quite the same control and power that Nebuchadnezzar had. So he's got these guys, the satraps, who would be kind of like our House of Representatives. So they're leaders over different areas, kind of an extension of his rule, an extension of his power. And over these, three governors, of whom Daniel was one. So you've got kind of your House of Representatives, and then probably all of those guys weren't on the up and up. You know, some of them may have been skimming from the pot, might have been dishonest. So over them, there was three kind of governors to manage those rulers and to check on them accountability-wise. And Daniel was one of them. So beneath Darius, he was in the top three as far as control. Now remember his background, he was a Hebrew youth that was taken captive and brought here into this pagan land. And he served the Lord here faithfully under these different pagan kings and their rules. But we'll see there's a line to what he does and what he doesn't do. So of these three governors, Daniel was one, that the satraps might give account to them so that the king would suffer no loss. So they couldn't steal from him. So these three were to protect the king and his treasures. Verse 3 says, then this Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and the satraps because an excellent spirit was in him. And the king gave thought to setting him over the whole realm. So already in a position of incredible power and authority, especially being a Hebrew, brought in and really ruling over these guys in the Mede and Persian Empire. That had to be humbling for them. So the proper message in that, or the thing that I think the motivation that should be given is, okay, we're watching Daniel, and it's not necessarily seniority, it's not birthright, it's not blood, but this guy has faithfully served the king and multiple kings. And he's advanced up through, and he's in this position of leadership, and now they're considering making him the number two guy, putting him directly under Darius and making him oversee kind of the three and all of the satraps. The message in that should be, so if I look at how Daniel's lived his life, and I model my life after Daniel, and I try to live by the same standard or exceed his standards, maybe I also could advance. Maybe I also could be given position. Maybe I also could be given power. But we'll see that even though Daniel distinguished himself above the governors and the satraps because this excellent spirit was in him, the king gave him thought to setting him over the whole realm. Verse 4, so the governors and satraps sought to find some charge against Daniel concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful. Nor was there any error or fault found in him. So rather than look at Daniel's life as kind of the blueprint for success, they said, how are we going to sabotage this guy? How can we destroy Daniel and keep him from advancing, keep him from getting this position of even greater authority? I know, we'll find some dirt. We'll do a background investigation. When I first got hired for the government, the FBI did a background check. And their background check, basically they would get references. You know, who can we talk to about you? And they would talk to them for like 5 minutes. Okay, who do you know that's ever had an issue or a problem with Brian? And then that would start their investigation. They would go and specifically kind of look for dirt or look for complaint against you. And that process, once they talk to your neighbors and once they talk to everybody that's ever had beef with you, took 18 months. Okay? So these guys, you've got hundreds here looking and searching to find fault, to find dirt on Daniel. But it says they sought to find some charge against Daniel, verse 4, concerning the kingdom, but they could find no charge or fault because he was faithful. Nor was there any error or fault found in him. Can you imagine that in one of our political leaders? One that has been chosen to govern in our lands, anywhere, any state. You know, can you imagine? I mean, like I said, Daniel was ballpark in his 80s here. And that may be a low estimate. It might be, like I said, 85, closer to 90. But there was not just no dirt, but no fault found in him. If you picture anyone in your mind, your boss, a coworker, we kind of become characterized by certain traits. Anybody seen like a great impressionist? Somebody that, like, when they go into character, they start doing somebody else. It's them. And the things they pick up on are like the distinguishing traits. And, I mean, there's character traits, there's mannerisms, there's expressions and all that, but then there's things that we're known by. You know, well, that guy's kind of a loudmouth, or that woman is super smart, or whatever it is. But Daniel was known throughout all this kingdom for his character and his relationship and faithfulness to his God. So these guys specifically look for dirt. There is no dirt. Going back years and years and years, they found no fault. The process that we go through politically in this country for our candidates and judges and all of that stuff, our vetting process, I think at this point is so extreme, kind of eliminates good candidates. You know, the people that probably should be in those roles fear this process because 20 years ago or 30 years ago, something existed in their life that they know will turn up. But they searched all of Daniel's life. All of, you know, what times he come into work, all of that. Did he come back late from break? And then looked at his specific character, and there was no fault found in him. So I want to make a point of that, because when we look at young Daniel back in the beginning of this book, we see that he distinguished himself in certain ways that he purposed in his heart not to defile himself. Remember, he wasn't going to defile himself with the king's delicacies, and he wasn't going to defile himself in certain ways. He made that decision ahead of time that he wasn't going to do that. And then at 80 years old, after years and years of faithful service to a pagan king, they look back and they go, we got nothing. We're not going to be as good as him, so let's find the dirt. But there's no dirt. There's nothing. So I want to point out some of his disciplines as we go through this, because it wasn't, like, it's easy to look at this and think, wow, Daniel, you know, Daniel was Daniel. Daniel was like an exceptional child, or Daniel must have had some extra Jesus chromosomes or something, because he wasn't like a normal person. But he was. He was just like us. So, verse 5, these men said, we shall not find any charge against Daniel unless we find it against him concerning the law of his God. The one thing, we know Daniel will not compromise on this, how he follows his God. So if we can find some kind of conflict with that, some kind of conflict with his obedience to his God, that's our ticket. So, verse 6. So these governors and satraps thronged before the king and said thus to him, King Darius, live forever. All the governors of the kingdom, look at that word, verse 7, all. All the governors of the kingdom, the administrators and satraps, the counselors and advisors, have consulted together to establish a royal statute and to make a firm decree that whoever petitions any god or man for 30 days except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. A couple of things. They thronged before the king. Doesn't just mean they like flailed themselves, but they all gathered together in mass to make it look like there's 100% unity on this. Everyone agreed. In fact, they say all the governors of the kingdom, who's missing from that? Who didn't show up? Who wasn't invited? Daniel, right? Daniel wasn't included in this decision. But they come and they overwhelmingly present this to the king. O king, live forever. And they start to flatter him. They've consulted together to establish a royal statute, to make a firm decree that whoever petitions any god or man for 30 days except you, O king, O awesome one, he shall be cast into the den of lions. Is flattery effective? I think it's like the most effective tool out there. Certainly the most powerful tools, I think, in politics. You know, start telling somebody how great they are. And what else? What else have you noticed about me? Kind of thing. So his head gets puffed up. He believes all of these guys. Anybody know? Flattery is a powerful tool. Flattery is when things are said about somebody that may or may not be true in an attempt to sway or manipulate. But I don't want to say, yeah, I will say flattery is bad. But I do want to distinguish there's a difference between flattery and encouragement. You know, encouragement is a powerful gift from the Lord. And I think encouragement is a gift that is underutilized, particularly in the church. You know, it's so careful about pride and so careful about puffing people up that we often fail to just encourage and recognize positive things in people's lives. And it's almost like a small version of this where, okay, I'm looking at Daniel and I could never be a Daniel, so I'm going to tear Daniel down. You know, we look at positive things in people's lives or growth in people's lives that, you know, maybe even in some areas they're doing way better than us. And rather than recognize that and encourage or exhort that intense encouragement, utilizing that, sometimes we shy away from that because we're afraid of puffing somebody up or making them prideful. And encouragement is a powerful gift to be used and exercised in the church. That's part of our gathering. When we gather, we're to exhort each other and stir up love and good works, right? Flattery, I don't know if I'm explaining the difference between the two. You want to know what flattery is? If you were to get dressed in your very finest clothes that you have and do your hair, men, and your makeup, women, and go down to any of the car dealerships on the Hogan Road, I want to get it right, and walk into the car dealership and just start walking around in your best dressed clothes, and when somebody runs up to you, if you're at the Chevy dealer, ask them, what's the difference between this truck fully loaded and the Denali? Am I going to get everything in that? And then you will see what flattery is. And you will start believing that you walk on water. And that's kind of the picture of what was going on here with King Darius. Is everybody gathers and they throng before the king. King, live forever. Make a firm decree, down in verse 7, and make a firm decree that whoever petitions any god or any man for 30 days except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions. Verse 8, now, O king, establish the decree and sign the writing so that it cannot be changed according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter. Therefore, King Darius signed the written decree. So they kind of come in like a tidal wave. They flatter him. They come up with this thing. Oh, hey, I got a great idea. It's already written. We know Daniel's faithful to his God. Maybe he can hold out for a day or two, but certainly not 30 days. So do this for 30 days. Remember in chapter 2, the dream that Nebuchadnezzar had, the image with the head of gold, and then it went down to the silver. And I talked about kind of, because we're going to get into something similar next chapter, but I talked about the head being gold because Nebuchadnezzar had ultimate power. He was a monarchy of one. Basically, when he spoke, every time he spoke, it was law. Anything that came out of his mouth was law. The difference here, when you get into the Medes and Persians and you go lower down that scale, this king was still the most powerful person basically in the world at this time, but his authority was not all his own. The idea here of the law of the Medes and Persians can't be changed is once a law was made, it couldn't be changed, in the meaning that even the king didn't have the authority to change it. Where Nebuchadnezzar, if he spoke something into law, he could immediately say, you know what, that was kind of dumb, or I was being flattered, and I don't want to change that, so it's changed because I spoke it. Here, the whole practice was set up basically so that nobody could manipulate the law. Nobody could bribe their way out of following the law. Even the king was subject to the law once a law was made. So he signs this decree, and according to the law of the Medes and Persians, it could not be altered. It couldn't be changed for the king. It couldn't be changed for Daniel. It couldn't be changed for the highest bidder, you know, that would come and try to bribe all the satraps or anything like that. Once a law was made, it could not be changed. So Darius did not have the same authority and power that a Nebuchadnezzar had. So he signed the written decree, so it was law and an unchangeable law. Verse 10 says, now when Daniel knew that the writing was signed, he went home. So it wasn't like Daniel was unaware. Daniel knew, and he went home in verse 10. And in his upper room with the windows open toward Jerusalem, he knelt down on his knees 3 times that day and prayed and gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since the early days. He didn't hide. He did not do it. Not for a day, not for 30 days. In verse 10, he knew the writing was signed. He went home, and that very day, he knelt 3 times and prayed. It's interesting. I'm trying to remember exactly where. Somewhere in my notes it says, but there's a passage in the Old Testament that talks about when Israel is taken captive, that if they pray and face towards Jerusalem, the Lord will restore. And I think that may have been some of what Daniel was doing, but this was his practice, and this was his discipline. And this is one of the things that I want to point out is yesterday for Daniel, right? This thing was signed today. He was aware of it. He went home and he did this very thing, but he did this very thing yesterday. And he did this very thing last week. And he did this thing the week before. And he's 80, serving in this pagan nation. And like I said, we look at Daniel, we look at a young Daniel who purposed in his heart not to defile himself. And then we look at old Daniel that's taking this incredible stand. And it's been his practice and it's been his discipline. So, like, why was Daniel this incredible man of God that there was no fault in? Was it just because it was like a genetic thing? Or like I said, he had some extra Jesus chromosomes? Or was it kind of a result of his relationship and his practice with God? Because this was not legalism in his life, and it was not religion in his life. Daniel had a discipline of, this is my practice. And, you know, doing this Sunday after Sunday and Wednesday after Wednesday, oftentimes, you know, you don't want to beat up people, but I encourage you, particularly if you end up back there for good or bad, for counsel, one of the things I ask is, do you have a daily prayer time with the Lord? Are you spending time daily in the Word? This thing that's living and powerful and changes our lives. Do you have that discipline in your life? Not a religious thing, or like, oh, I didn't do it today, so I'm going to condemn myself forever. But like, you look at why Daniel was who Daniel was, why he was the man that he was, and this was a practice that was ingrained in his life, so much so that the people around him looked at him and said, you know what, the only way we're going to get him is with his relationship with his God. If we can tie something to that, so let's look, oh, we can't find anything, so let's make something up so that his faithful practice with the Lord is going to be a violation of something that we do. So he goes to the upper room. He went home in his upper room with his windows open towards Jerusalem. He knelt down on his knees 3 times that day. He prayed. He gave thanks before his God, as was his custom since his early days. So this is not a, certainly the people that are here on Wednesday night, if I were to get a positive answer from this, it would probably be from you guys. You know, but if I were to ask this question, how many of us did this today? How many of us prayed 3 times to God today, specifically for our country or our church or the salvation of the lost or any of those things? How many of us got down on our knees to pray? I mean, there's all kinds of different positions to pray from, all kinds of different biblical positions to pray from. Certainly we can have arms raised up and head towards the sky and all of that. But there is something to Daniel's posture of prayer and the humility of being on our knees before God. And that gets harder as you get older. You know, and Daniel's 80. But there's value in that, at least on occasion, that we would remember to do that and get on our knees before God with our petitions and our prayers. I think I put 2 Chronicles up there, if you want to go to the next slide. Yeah. This verse, a little out of context, but if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and I will forgive their sin and heal their land. And I can't help but read this from Daniel, and that he's not just under the authority of a pagan king, but he's working for him. He's part of the government. He's high up in government. And he's calling out to God all the time for change. 3 times a day, makes a discipline of it. That's what he does. And then I look at this verse, and it says, if my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their wicked ways, then I will hear from heaven and forgive their sin and heal their land. I look, you know, some of us are older, some of us are younger. We can remember, some of us can only remember a couple presidents, some of us can remember many. You know, but there was a time in this nation where if you were to run for the highest office in the land, you basically had to be a Christian or lie and say you were, you know, or that you believed. And I actually think, short of revival, that we're kind of in a place where that's a detriment, running for that office. I mean, can you imagine in this land if an openly professing man like Daniel were to run for president, were to run for any office? We should be the biggest cheerleaders, you know, lead the campaign. But would they even have a chance of being elected, short of revival in this country? You know, I almost think we've passed that point. Next verse, where were we? 11? 10? Now Daniel knew that, yeah, all right. Verse 11, then these men assembled and found Daniel. So the ones that set him up, the ones that wrote the law, the ones that went to the king and had him sign the law, These men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. And they went before the king, and they spoke concerning the king's decree. Have you not signed? Daniel knew this. And Daniel knew the consequences of this. Remember the scene. Turn to Acts chapter 5, if you will. I think it's Acts chapter 5. Remember the disciples were in prison. Acts chapter 5, actually, I'll just start in verse 22. But when the officers came and did not find them in prison, they returned and reported, saying, indeed, we found the prison shut securely and the guards standing outside before the doors. But when we opened them, we found no one inside. And now when the high priest, the captain of the temple, and the chief priest heard these things, they wondered what the outcome would be. So one came and told them, saying, look, the men who you put in prison are standing in the temple and teaching the people. Then the captain went with the officers and brought them without violence, for they feared the people, lest they should be stoned. Verse 27, and when they had brought them, they set them before the council, and the high priest asked them, saying, did we not strictly command you not to teach in this name? And look, you have filled Jerusalem with your doctrine and intend to bring this man's blood upon us. Verse 29, but Peter and the other apostles answered and said, we ought to obey God rather than men. The God of our fathers raised up Jesus, whom you murdered by hanging on a tree. We ought to obey God rather than men. Daniel was faced with that choice. And I'll also say Daniel didn't petition for everyone else to join him. Daniel was just faithful in his prayers. But Daniel knew what the consequence of this would be, right? Because it says he knew that the writing was signed. He knew what the threat was. And I think Daniel, particularly at 80, looked at this practice in his life and looked at the value of this relationship with God and said, okay, I'm not willing to give that up for anything, for any prize, for any petition, for any threat that may become me. This is not worth giving up for that or the avoidance of that. So, verse 11 again, the guys that set him up, the guys that couldn't find anything wrong with him, so they tried to create something so his faithful relationship with God would be a violation of the law. Verse 11 says, these men assembled and found Daniel praying and making supplication before his God. No surprise. And they went before the king and spoke concerning the king's decree. Have you not signed a decree that every man who petitions any god or man within 30 days except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? So the idea is sort of, they show up before Darius and they're like, oh, hey, I was going to ask you, didn't you sign something? Does that ring a bell to you at all? Did this happen, this thing? Because we just happened to notice Daniel, right? Have you not signed a decree that every man who petitions any god or man within 30 days except you, O king, shall be cast into the den of lions? The king answered and said, the thing is true according to the law of the Medes and Persians, which does not alter. So kind of, yeah, I did it. How's it going, boys? You know, anybody violating it? Anybody worshiping anybody but me? Verse 13, so they answered and said before the king, that Daniel, who was one of the captives from Judah, that slave you captured from Judah, does not show, or not him, but Nebuchadnezzar, does not show due regard for you. So they make it personal, right? It's not even he violated the law or did this thing, but he shows no regard for you, O king, or for the decree that you have signed, but makes his petition three times a day. Verse 14, and the king, when he heard these words, was greatly displeased with himself. Not with Daniel. I mean, he knows what Daniel's about. He knows Daniel's faithful. But this realization, like the light bulb goes on, that he was duped. And he was prideful. And he was flattered and tricked by these men. He was greatly displeased with himself. And he set his heart on Daniel to deliver him. Didn't set his heart necessarily on finding a way to manipulate, but he actually set his heart on Daniel. Cared about what happened to Daniel. He set his heart on Daniel to deliver him, and he labored till the going down of the sun to deliver him. So he starts searching out. Is there any way? Is there any loophole? Is there any way around this? Because again, he doesn't have the authority of a Nebuchadnezzar. Verse 15, then these men approached the king and said to the king, know, O king, that it is the law of the Medes and Persians that no decree or statute which the king establishes may be changed. Let's just remind you of this, king. You don't have the authority to change this. The law is the law. Verse 16, so the king gave the command, and they brought Daniel and cast him into the den of lions. But the king spoke, saying to Daniel, your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you. What's interesting is we have no narrative of any relationship between this king and Daniel prior to this, other than he was in a position of leadership. But all that this king knew about Daniel's God, all what the people knew about Daniel's God was what they saw in the life of Daniel. You know, and by observation, this guy looks at Daniel and he says, your God, whom you serve continually, he will deliver you. We'll see he's got some doubt on that. Then a stone, verse 17, was brought and laid on the mouth of the den, and the king sealed it with his own signet ring and with the signets of his lords, that the purpose concerning Daniel might not be changed. Now the king went to his palace and spent the night fasting, and no musicians were brought before him. So the normal party, the normal playing of the music and drinking and all that didn't happen. He's actually fasting for Daniel and sleepless. Also his sleep went from him. Then verse 19, the king arose very early in the morning and went in haste to the den of the lions. And when he came to the den, he cried out with a lamenting voice to Daniel. The king spoke, saying to Daniel, Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions? Daniel, don't worry about it. Let me encourage you. Your God's going to deliver you. Hey, Daniel, you okay? Did your God deliver you? The God that you serve continually? So they cast him into the lion's den. Prior to this, opening the doors, there's historically a bunch of stuff that validates that this was a tool that they used, but not to get all National Geographic, but an hour before it's time to eat, my dog walks over to that food dish and starts laying there whining. You know, he just knows, hungry, what hungry does in an animal. And if you've ever seen a lion attack another animal, it's not a pleasant, easy thing to see. You know, they don't have humane ways of dispatching their prey. They catch their prey and they begin eating until the animal dies, and then they continue eating. So this whole scene was not like Daniel gets thrown into the lion's den and these guys are just sleeping and ignoring him. You know, I'm sure they're growling and they're pacing, and we don't have all that, but these are lions. It doesn't say that they were stuffed from the night before. I don't know if you've ever been like that, but you eat too much meat, and it's like, oh, I can't eat another bite. You know, it wasn't that with them at all. The Lord did something amazing here. So Daniel, servant of the living God, has your God, whom you serve continually, been able to deliver you from the lions? Verse 21, then Daniel said to the king, O king, live forever. My God sent his angel to shut the lions' mouths so that they have not hurt me, because I was found innocent before him. And also, O king, I have done no wrong before you. Now the king was exceedingly glad for him and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatever was found on him, because he believed in his God. Because he believed in his God. Now, I love Daniel. I love his example. But even in 21, the guy that just threw him in the lion's den, that was duped, O king, live forever. There's no hostility. There's no vengeance in him. My God sent his angel. Immediately he begins to testify. You know, none of us have actually been in a physical lion's den. But we've all been in lion's dens to different degrees. You know, I can see Daniel being in that spot thinking, man, I hope this brings glory to God. My tragedy, my trial, I can't wait to see what God does with it, who he speaks to. And man, what if we, like Daniel, prayed one time a day for our church, for our country, every day, two times a day, three times a day, humbled ourselves, did the things that Daniel did? Because I don't remember being in a lion's den saying, Lord, I hope somebody's moved by this. You know, it's usually, Lord, I'm afraid of lions. Get me out of here. Rescue me. God has sent his angel to shut the lion's mouth so that they have not hurt me, because I was found innocent before him, and O king, I have done no wrong before you. Now the king, verse 23, was exceedingly glad for him and commanded that they should take Daniel up out of the den. So Daniel was taken up out of the den, and no injury whatsoever was found on him, because he believed in his God. And the king gave the command, and they brought those men who had accused Daniel, and they cast them into the den of lions. Now, if you're going to play the game that these guys played, you have to be prepared to play the price. You better make sure you win. You know, if you're going to flatter people in leadership, you're going to do things and mess around to this degree. So the king then orders these guys, and it says, them, their children, and their wives were brought. Now, nowhere in here are we told that God did this for revenge, or God condoned the killing of their children. But it says this king, Darius, did this. The king gave the command, and they brought those men who had accused Daniel. Remember, he was upset with himself for being manipulated by these guys. They cast them into the den of lions, them, their children, and their wives. Why would they throw the kids in there? Any ideas? You throw mom in there, throw dad in there. The next generation maybe seeks revenge after this king, you know. Take away any threat. Throw them all in the hole. They cast them into the den of lions, them, their children, their wives, and the lions overpowered them and broke all their bones in pieces before they ever came to the bottom of the den. So again, these lions didn't leave Daniel alone because they were full. Or they didn't like human flesh. They devoured these guys. Then King Darius wrote to all peoples, verse 25, to all peoples, nations, and languages that dwell in all the earth, peace be multiplied to you. I make a decree that in every dominion of my kingdom, men must tremble and fear, not just believe in or follow or do the things that Daniel did, but all men must tremble and fear before the God of Daniel, for he is the living God and steadfast forever. His kingdom is the one which shall not be destroyed, and his kingdom shall endure till the end. He delivers and rescues, and he works in signs and wonders in heaven and on earth. Who has delivered Daniel from the power of the lions? So this Daniel prospered in the reign of Darius and in the reign of Cyrus the Persian, who we'll talk about more later. So chapter 7 picks up the prophetic side of the book of Daniel, and that's where we'll go. It's next week, Christmas Eve week. No? Good. Okay. All right, let's pray. Father, Lord, I thank you for your word, and I thank you that you are sovereign, Lord, and we look at things from such a limited perspective, and we see Daniel getting tossed into a den of lions, and in our minds and hearts, Lord, the next page reads, he was toast, he was done. But Lord, you are in control of the world, and you're in control of our lives. And Lord, if we are in a place like Daniel in a lion's den, we're in a place where everyone else that we work with or everyone else that we know conspires against us, Lord, may we trust in you. And where we don't, Lord, give us the faith to do that very thing. We pray this in Jesus' name. Amen.